Yeah, so we got back to Gizzy and we'd grown up, yeah, as I said, with my grandfather, we'd grown up hunting and fishing in this beautiful forest, Tawa Forest, Kahikatea, Rimu, Tōtara, and these lovely bouldery streams. And I remember as a kid, there were feel everywhere. Every time you went fishing, there were our blue ducks were like bouncing their way down the rapids, and as you fell asleep at night, the kiwi were calling, and you'd hear them from inside the hut and as you slept on your mattress. And that was the life I experienced with my father and my grandfather and my grandmother. And we got back to the Waiwereka where we grew up hunting and fishing. And there were next to like there were pretty much no fuel left. And we went and no kiwi too. And we got together a couple of my hunting mates. I was like, this isn't right, eh? Like we've been away, like all of us had been away, as you do as young fellas. Like we'd been away, like looking after other people's ngahere, looking after other people's rivers, and looking after their species and helping them flourish down in Fiordland and Ruahine and Te Iriwera and that. And we got back home and they were just gone. And we're like, far, no one's really been looking after anything at home. So yeah, we went to Doc and said, hey team, what's going on? And Doc, that usual story, eh? Doc
Yeah.
didn't have the budget to do, they are doing great work in the region, but in that particular neck of the woods where we grew up hunting and fishing, they didn't have the budget for it. So, oh, okay, went to council, same thing. It dawned on us that it might be on us to look after the place that had been feeding our families for generations.
Hello, kia ora, and welcome to the People Helping Nature podcast brought to you by Conservation Amplified.
Our show features the stories of people who are helping nature to bring more awareness to this amazing space.
I'm Anna.
And I'm Callum. And today, we're joined by Sam the Trap Man. Welcome.
Kia ora, kōrua. How are you doing?
So good. And you?
Oh, I'm so happy to be on your podcast, guys. Like, this is a neat initiative. It's a beautiful sunny day here in the Tairāwhiti. What could go wrong?
As so often, it wasn't the most beautiful day in cloudy Rotorua, but I'm glad to have you on. Let's get into it.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks for being here. To start with, can you want to just introduce yourself, how you got to where you are, especially your upbringing in the Ngāhere, the bush?
Oh, well, I'm Sam the Trap Man. I'm Hamiura Gibson, but Sam the Trap Man works. I was raised in Gisborne. Well, actually, let's start the story at the beginning. I stuffed up my parents' OE. They were traveling the world, climbed Everest, they were cruising around in a combi van in Europe, and I popped out on a mattress in the attic of a stone thatch roofed apple barn. And there you go, I started my life over in England, but mum and dad quickly came back to Gisborne, where our whānau are from, and dad built us a house, Lockwood House, on the banks of the Hamanatua stream. And so my parents were lovely. My dad's a teacher, my mum is a nurse, and they both had a hankering for the outdoors and the bush. And yeah, I've just been kicking around the scrub ever since, really. How deep do you guys want me to go on that one?
Yeah, well, what happened next? I had a bit of trouble growing up, which led you to go bush, right?
Yeah, so I kind of grew up with my grandparents being a pretty massive influence in my life. My grandfather was a hunter and a fisherman, and my grandmother also came along on a lot of those adventures. And me being the eldest grandchild, I was taken along on lots of these adventures, which was great growing up in Gisborne. But when they passed away, we moved to the Hawke's Bay, which was awesome. I went to a Steiner school. The school was great. But when you move a country bumpkin to the city, in their teenage years, things are bound to go a little awry. And so I found myself being quite distracted, and distracted to the point where my parents and my principal made a deal with me that they would send me bush up into Te Uruwera for the middle week of every term, because I was finding 10 weeks in a term, I was getting a little too distracted. And so they sent me in the bush for the middle week of every term and sent me bush on the holidays. They sent me up to Te Uruwera. and the boys in Te Uruwera started to mould me into a trapper and started to show me that the ngahere, the bush, was everything I needed in my life. When we were hungry, it fed us. When we're thirsty, it gave us water to drink. When we hurt ourselves, it healed us too. So it was somewhere where a gangly 12 to 17-year-old could thrive. I was no good at sports. I wasn't particularly good at footwork, but in the bush, I did all right. So they showed me what was important in life, and slowly the distractions of, we won't get into all those distractions, I don't think, but they slowly eased in importance to me rather than the all the goodness that the bush could provide me. Yeah, if that makes sense. And I ended up having a career in the forest, which is pretty nice.
Pick. That's cool.
Pick. Touching on that career in the forest, you started, you spent some time down in Fjordland and pretty punishing rugged terrain with Doc. What was that like as an experience?
That was great. Like, Fjordland is absolute paradise when you are working in it. It has the steepest hills I think I've ever come across in my life. And the coldest winters. And we were living in situations like it would be snow on the ground outside, and we weren't allowed to have fires in our huts because they didn't want us cutting down the beautiful native forest to fuel the fires in the huts. So we had no fireplaces in our huts. They were like tin boxes. And you notice you go to the mattresses and they all had slits down the middle of them where you kind of cut a slit open with your hunting knife and pushed your sleeping bag down inside the mattress as a layer of extra insulation. So it was pretty chilly. Yeah, but you know, like it was a situation where every week was a helicopter trip. Every week was a jet boat trip. One day you'd be jumping out of helicopters, running down the mountains and catching takahe to monitor them, and other times you'd be catching bats that bite your fingers at night, and other times you'd be changing transmitters on fuel, you know, and other times we were just out there killing things. So it was great. I was a trapper. Fjordland was amazing, but it was a big difference from Te Uruwera. You know, Te Uruwera is so nurturing. It's always trying to feed you. It's always being generous. It's always trying to give you a kai. And I, being from up here, I was so used to the bush feeding us. And then I got to Fjordland and it's pretty harsh and it's beech forest and there's not a lot of tucker in it. So you have to fly in food and all these things it was a bit of a culture shock, but not a people culture shock. It was just that the bush is kind of different. But it was a very exciting time. I did 3 years and I think, one winter I worked just about every day. So they told me I had to take summer off. So I flew up to North Island to take summer off. But yeah, it was great. It was brilliant.
Wow. Must be pretty good if that's the case. But I got to say, I was reading some of this stuff in your new book, which we'll get to a bit later in this chat. It sounded like some pretty hard going in the bush. Like, it wasn't just the rugged terrain, but man, those huts sounded rough. They didn't sound like something on a Great Walks track. I want to quote something from your book. They had us camped up in a working man's hut called Rocky Point. Instead of building it on high, dry rocks overlooking the river, as the name suggested, they had generously built it on top of a swamp. The walls were thick with black mold, and water seeped up through the floorboards each time you took a step. Condensation dripped from the ceiling, and if you left your sleeping bag on the mattress in the morning, you could guarantee it would be a soggy mess by the time you returned. There was an old coal range in the kitchen without any coal, and the wood in the bush, as you could imagine, was perpetually wet. What a life.
I wrote that, I guess, but it does... It does sum up kind of how we were living back then, eh? And we were proud of ourselves for living like that. It was pretty rough. It was pretty horrible, and winter got to you after a while. But, you know, we were out there to do a job. We believed a lot, and we still do believe a lot in what we were doing. We were actively saving endangered species at that time. You know, like, that was at a time where, like, it was potential that species were going locally extinct, and we were out there doing the work. You know, we're running those trap lines, we're establishing those bait station networks. So, you know, we believed in what we did, and we our pride overrid the discomfort that we were experiencing. And I've got a shout out to my mate Phil Collins. Everywhere I went in those 3 years, I had a good mate by my side. And Phil kept me going with his, he's just got a really humble, really dry sense of humour. And I reckon it would be easy to go bush mad in Fiordland in a winter if you didn't have a good mate along with you. So, yeah, Phil got me through. He's a little short guy, half Filipino, half Scottish. He's a bit of a legend, but if it wasn't for that fellow, I think I'd be nuts by now.
He's not not the musician you're talking about, right?
No, not that Phil Collins. No, not okay. The gorilla on the Cadbury ad, Phil Collins. He's a crafty bushman.
Right. So you cut your teeth in Fiordland, learned a lot of skills there. What happened next?
Well, in Fiordland, you know, I think it'd be fair to say that I had a hankering for the North Island again, a bit of fruit, vegetables, forest that was happy to feed you in some warmth and sunshine. I mean, and the sandflies kind of get you down, to be fair. So I made a move for the North Island. I went back to the Hawke's Bay where my family were living and, set up shop in Hawke's Bay for a while. And that was good. And then later on progressed up the coast to Gizzy. Yeah.
And making that move, you kind of started your own little project with a couple of mates. Is that right?
Which I don't know why it hadn't occurred to us at the time, but we just assumed it was someone else's responsibility. We got together with a group of like seven of our hunting mates and we thought, we'll see if we can set up a conservation project.
I guess right, you went down to Fiordland to look after their nahere. So I guess you kind of always think that gets reciprocated. But in your case, you probably picked up quite some skills down there to then apply in your own little patch?
Oh, I've been so lucky in my life, you know. Like a mutual friend of ours, I came up under a man, Lindsay Wilson, and he's had a hand in more groundbreaking conservation projects than pretty much anyone in this country. And Darren Peters, you know, he's probably had more of a hand in wild trapping eradications and wild trapping projects. Like he's worked on puffins and over in Hawaii, he's just got back from some island in between Hawaii and like Japan somewhere in the middle there in the Pacific. So I came up under these Dan Bajant, Hemi Bastel, you know, there's so many great trappers that when I came through in the bush, there weren't that many young fellas. And so I was really lucky that these guys put me under their wing and let me carry their traps for them. So, yeah, we learned a few skill sets under those legends and I was really lucky to bring some of those home to help look after our bush over here. Yeah.
Did you know when you were growing up just the significance of the people you were learning from? Like, you know, I see these stories and think this is a world first, but as a kid, did you think, oh, these are just some guys teaching me stuff in the bush? Or did you actually realize how significant what you were learning was?
I knew how significant it was for me as someone that kind of didn't, I'm terrible at sports, you know, and wasn't particularly socially savvy, you know. So being able to sit in a hut and listen to these guys talk conservation and strategize and, you know, they'd be there drinking their whiskey and I'd be there with my herbal tea, you know, and you know, I'd just sit there quietly on the bunk in the evening as the fire crackled and they would be speaking about the need for, we were using fen traps and they were like, well, what if we designed a trap that actually had more killing power and was actually humane and I reckon we'd get less pullouts? And they were talking about those things and lo and behold, Darren Peters and Phil Washington designed the Doc series of traps.
Oh, really?
And I was there in those first conversations around the fire, you know, and then later on, we go, well, what if one of these traps actually killed something and then reset itself and then could kill something else? Because, like, what we're finding is we're catching heaps of rats, but then those traps aren't available for stoats, which is what we need to be killing, you know. And so, again, round the fire, there's a fella there, a bald-head short fella from Wellington. He's a bit of a coffee drinker, Robbie Van Dam, and they said, why don't you, you're a bloody designer, why don't you bloody design one of these traps? And sure enough, birth of resetting traps, and then other companies have kind of furthered that thinking as well. So I don't think I realized the pivotal role that being raised in that environment around those incredible people had on conservation. I realized it was important to me because it was the only place I've really felt good at doing something. But it's amazing that New Zealanders are the conservation leaders for predator control, ungulate control, pretty much all of that conservation for the world. Like, there's anytime there's an eradication job around the world, they get New Zealanders to do it. It's amazing, eh? And anytime there's a new tool that's designed for predator control, guess what? New Zealand designed and made. So, like, I thought at the time we were just bushmen doing our bit for Te Uruwera that fed us. Yeah, I guess the flow on from that is that around the world we've got some pretty incredible islands that are now predator free, and we're in a space in Aotearoa where we're no longer worried about species going extinct, but through that work that we did in the bush and those conversations, that technology that got built off the back of it, we are no longer worried about whether something goes extinct or not. We're actually bringing them back to, like, major cities. So, yeah,
I don't know. Amazing. It's funny you say that. Anna and I had the privilege, absolute privilege, to go to Campbell Island over Christmas, and that's 700 kilometers south of the South Island, and it was about 100,000 rats were removed and lots of other stuff, cattle and sheep. And that was actually Lindsay Wilson, your mentor and boss, who was doing that. And I didn't realize at the time, but that was a world first, and the methodology they pioneered there has now been used to remove pests from South Georgia Island and lots of others around the world. And yeah, it comes back to the same concept, you know, that we volunteer in a forest up the hill here and in the Bay of Plenty, and lure things with what's the rope that they put down on them?
Oh, they designed or redesigned bait stations for it to either have the fill proofs to either be for rats or possums by having a special insert, and then they've put a rope on the bottom because they were finding that the rats were actually struggling to get to the fill proofs because they had to put them at a certain height because of other species. And just little innovations like that that keeps making the game better and better, I guess.
But it comes back to, like, you know, you were saying sitting around the hut at night and we could do this differently. And it's the same in so many different situations where it's not some people with a major R&D budget in a lab. It's people out in the field that are just doing their thing and see a problem and fix it. And, you know, when you're on the ground, you think, oh, that's cool. But when you realize, actually, this is changing our natural environments here and around the world, it's quite humbling, really, to think of.
It's so humbling, eh? And I think that's, being from our country, we're pretty self-depreciating, eh? So, like, I don't think we naturally think that we're going to have any major impact, and we're pleasantly surprised when we do, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, nah, she'll be right.
Speaking of predator control, something that you mentioned in your book and that I really resonated with was talking about the mana of the predator itself and how it's important to uphold that. And then you also said something along the lines of every animal they're introduced here, they're home to some other country. And I happen to be from one of these countries. I was born, you know, overseas, just like you. And at the moment, currently, as a conservationist, I'm starting to get worried that we're losing that perspective, that predator has its own mana, and that it's actually part of our job as a conservationist to respect that as well. And what are your thoughts and what's your own perspective on that?
Yeah, I think that's a big value that underpins how we do things in our part of the world. But I also think it's something that, you know, I'm 100% behind the predator-free movement. I'm so grateful for the conservation might that's come behind that movement. It's great. But I am a little concerned also that is one thing that we're losing. But yeah, that's just how we do things in our part of the world, you know. As a hunter, we always need to uphold the mana of our kai, because our kai comes into our puku and it goes into the puku of our whānau and our friends as well. So I think you wouldn't want to eat something that through the process of death has been degraded, eh? That would just feel weird, you know. So as a hunter and as a bushman, that's just how we were raised. My grandfather taught me that's how we roll when we're hunting and we're fishing. But when I went to Te Uruwera, it took on a whole new meaning. There were a lot of conversations that we had. Each of these species, like how cool is a stoat, right? Their heart beats three times faster than the human heart. They can run up like vertical surfaces, you know? They only have to eat every 10 days. It's like they're so cool. And like the whole thing about like insemination and being able to like change the feed, the number of fetuses based on like the amount of food availability, right? Like that is some like incredible adaptation. And so I look at all of these species as taonga species. You know, some people get real upset with me. It can't be a taonga species if they're not. Well, hang on. A stoat has whakapapa to Europe. In Europe, there are stoat preservation societies. I belong to a stoat preservation society. Why? Because I believe that, you know, we all have whakapapa to different parts in the world, but those that live in England love stoats, and they are genuinely incredible species, and they're a taonga to those people over there. I think I'd be doing those people a disservice if I killed a stoat in a negative way or I thought badly about who a stoat is. It's like some Aboriginal peoples over in Australia, they make cloaks out of the possum skins. You know, there's been some work done here on the East Coast. Graham Atkins has headed it up with cultural exchanges between Aboriginal peoples and tangata whenua here. And the similarities is that, you know, they make cloaks out of the possum and they revere them as part of their whānau, as part of their whakapapa. And what do we make? We make our cloaks out of here in Aotearoa? Kākahu kiwi, eh? So we use our kiwi to make our cloaks, and we love kiwi. No one can tell us that we don't love kiwi here in Aotearoa. And so we love kiwi. We used to eat kiwi, just like kākāpō used to eat kākāpō, and we used to use their feathers and skins to make cloaks, and we revere them. And so the kiwis are taonga, but also the possums are taonga to the people of Australia. But they're just in the wrong place. But I think the real interesting thing to me about that is that how many young fellas do we got coming through that think nothing of smacking a possum over the head with a hammer until it dies a pretty gnarly death? Mm-hmm. And so that's what we try to teach people in the Eastern Fuel Link Project and in our part of the world, is that we need to whakamana these predators and these browsers through death rather than whakaiti them. If that makes sense, we need to keep their mana intact as our taonga, although we have to kill them rather than treat them with disrespect. And I think that's something that we are kind of lacking a little bit of these days. Mm-hmm. Eh?
Thank you for sharing. I love that approach. I can resonate a lot with that. I really hope that more people are open-minded enough to adapt that.
I think it's straight. I just think it's the way we do things, you know? I don't know. Did you guys come up you know, you have to kill a few sheep to feed the family every now and then. And, you know, the odd deer, that's just part of, you definitely have to kill the roosters when they come through the chicken coop. You know what I mean? Like that just is. And I feel like sometimes when, I don't know if this is accurate, but sometimes when people are raised in cities, they don't have a close relationship with death. And so they almost aren't, it's not ingrained in them to treat death with reverence, and it's not ingrained in them how to bring other lives through that process of death. What do you guys think? How are you guys raised with that sort of stuff?
Well, I'm a big city slicker from the from the hazy smoke of Auckland. No, I escaped Auckland as soon as I could, but no, seriously, I grew up where you have your chicken and chicken breasts that you get from the supermarket, and so I didn't see this. I think to me, it's just an ingrained respect for any animal or bird or species that you care for them. If you're not, then who are you as a person, right? And that's karma. It's going to come back to get you. That's just my personal belief. It's like, you know, what makes you any more important than that animal? But growing up, I never had any of that. If you wanted to beat an animal up, well then, I mean, obviously my friends and family would probably judge me, but there was no major cultural don't do that. So I was definitely came up on the other end of the spectrum, not seeing that. So it's really, I can see how people go down that path of, oh, they're stoats, they're we just need to kill them and their life doesn't matter. But and I'm not sure what the solution is to bridge that gap. I think it's all in education. I think it's a matter of, like, people don't know unless they know, but at the same time, your kaupapa, how you go about, you know, your foundation, your belief is going to affect that.
Yeah, I just want to touch on that education, because that's exactly what happened to me. You know, I grew up in Germany and we just go to the supermarket. There's no, often no, any thought really of where that comes from. And when I came to New Zealand a few years in, I had this amazing privilege to live in central Otago on a lifestyle block. And that was my first experience of, we have our own flock of sheep and they feed us. That's why we have them. That's one of their main purposes. And they all had names. The day came where they were, you know, going to butcher one of their sheep. And I was asked if I wanted to be part of that. And part of me thought, this is going to be horrific. I just want to run away. And then there was this little voice in my head and was like, hey, Anna, where do you actually think the meat that you buy from the supermarket comes from? This is an actual chance to learn and to expose yourself to something that you at that moment perceive as uncomfortable. And Sam, I've got to say, I'm so glad I made the choice to stick around and to see that entire process of taking a life, of skinning and gutting that animal, and then being grateful that a life was given to sustain us. And that was a really crucial moment on my personal journey of actually, it just made click then and there, being like, there's this side to life I haven't considered well into my 20s that we all actually need to think about a little bit more. And it was kind of something beautiful in embracing that process and starting to learn about what that means.
Yeah, I think there's something like inherently, you know, like that feeling either goes one of two ways for people, they often go, oh, that's really uncomfortable, I don't want to be around that, and they go, nah, ethically, vegetarian, vegan, pipe, and I respect that too. You know, there's another way of operating in the world. But then there's another lot of us that go, actually, the most important thing is to be connected to that process and not put that on. Because I don't know anyone that enjoys killing something, eh? Like,
yeah,
I know some pretty redneck hunters, eh? And like, I don't know anyone that really enjoys killing something. Like, people don't really kill things for fun, I don't think. Well, I don't know many of them. And so it's interesting, eh, that whole thing. And I've had a couple of experiences in my life that are really like reinforced that, eh. One time I was in Waikaremoana and I was trapping using old school fen traps. And I opened a box lid, and inside the box there was a rat, and it was caught by the gonads. And it was kind of looking up at me like, ooh. And I was like, ooh, that's got to be a bad way to die. And so, you know, caught by the gonads, starving to death, that's got to be a bad way to die. And gee. I kind of closed the box again. I go, phew, what do I do here? And in one way, I'm kind of really empathetic for this creature. But on the other way, if I let it go, it's just going to go eat the birds, right? And so, yeah, opened the box, did what needed to be done in as quick and efficient way as possible. But it really reinforced for me, hey, we need to move away from these fen traps pretty quick and move to a trap that's humane, you know. And I did the same thing in Fiordland a few times. I've done my share of toxin operations, and I've cleaned up afterwards. I've seen the animals passing in the way that they pass, and that way of killing something and being distant from it these days. As I say, I've got no judgment on anyone else, but just for me and my own practice as a conservation professional, I want to be as close to the taking of life and whakamana those animals through that process as I can. And I want them to die as quickly and humanely as possible, because they are all taonga. They're all taonga to their own ecosystems, and they are all taonga to their home indigenous people. And in a contemporary context, many non-indigenous people view each of these species as taonga in those ecosystems as well. So I think they're all worthy of respect.
For sure. On this topic, this connection between hunting and conservation that I'm really curious about. And in your book, you talk about there's a few times when there's been a deer that you're about to shoot, but it's too skinny or it's, you know, too small. And you think, okay, let's go for a different animal and leave that one there. And about upholding the mana of the animal in various ways. If I put my conservation hat on and I'm just thinking, regardless of the life, regardless of these things, purely conservation basis, I think if I take that deer or that pig out of the Nahiri, it's going to eat less of the understory and you're going to have more forest recover, more species. But on the other hand, it's not upholding the mana of the animal if you just kill it and dump it in the forest, right? How do you balance those two priorities? How do you go about thinking about that?
I'm really fortunate in my life to have, I know I sound like how I sound, but I've actually been to university, surprising, eh? And it's an interesting thing to me because when we understand population dynamics, by taking, one or two deer out of the population, quite likely as recreational hunters, we're never going to take more than 10 to 20% of the population,
Right, yeah.
It's just the reality of hunting. As recreational hunters, we're never going to take more than 10 to 20% out of the population. And when we take 10 to 20% out of the population as recreational hunters, we're just dropping the population enough and giving the ngākere enough of a break that it produces more food. When it produces more food, it actually increases the carrying capacity of that ecosystem, so there's more deer that are bred. And so the interesting thing is if we think we're doing conservation as a recreational hunter, we're actually increasing the carrying capacity of that forest to produce more deer than there ever were before. So I think that's how I handle it, is recreational hunting for me is about kai. When we get into the actual population control, we need to recognize that we need to do a concerted effort with really rigorous control methodologies. And I'm the same when it comes to trapping possums or stoats or running a possum over in the truck, Oh, if I'm going to run a possum over in the truck, oh, yeah, I feel good because I killed one possum. I'm actually creating more possums because the ecosystem's going to bounce back. If we're interested in controlling possums, we put in a trapping network over X amount of hectares at one trap per hectare or ridges and spurs, and we reduce that possum population consistently. With deer, it's the same. We don't. Anyone who thinks that we're recreationally hunting and controlling deer numbers needs to look at a little bit more science, I think. Yeah.
It's a great way of looking at it. And I don't claim to be a scientist or technical expert in this area. So that's really interesting. So what you're saying is that recreational hunting, getting kai, getting food, is if you try and take a we're going to control the population lens through that, you're actually not doing service to the forest and to the land. Whereas that's a completely different methodology and should be in a completely different bucket to if you're taking it from a conservation perspective.
Yeah, I think that it's so we've always been hunters here in Aotearoa. Ever since humans arrived in Aotearoa, they've hunted, right? At one point, we were hunting kereru and moa and kākāpō and all of these delicious tīti. Oh, they're so tasty. You eat in weka, they're really good too. There's all of these delicious species that we once hunted here in Aotearoa, and our peoples have always been hunters. Doesn't matter what whakapapa you share. You can't disconnect hunting from conservation in any way, shape, or form. And so the interesting thing to me, though, is that I would much rather our people be hunting the species that our ecosystems can afford to give them right now, rather than species that our ecosystems can't. Granted, one day I'm raising a young fella, my boy is 5 years old, and he said, Papa, we went to Kākāpō translocation at Maungatauturi some months ago, and he said to me, Papa, when can I have a pet kākāpō like my tīpuna did? Said, oh boy, that day is coming. That day is coming. Might not be in our generations, but that day is coming. And then he goes, Papa, when can I eat kereru like my tīpuna did? And he said it with quite a mournful loss type manner. And I said, boy, actually, that day's not too far away. It might even be within your generation, you know? And I think right now, our ecosystems can afford to give us deer. They can afford to give us pigs. It does no damage to the ecosystem for us to take that kite. It actually enhances them. It's like trout out of the riverways, right? By taking one or two, it creates a little bit of growth and it's good for the ecosystem, but it's not going to control those populations by any means. But the thing it is doing is it's a lot more beneficial than taking kakapo or kereru or any of these other delicious, and I'm not going to pretend they're not tasty because they must be, species out of the ecosystem. You know, it's a lot better to eat deer, a lot better to eat pigs than hunting our native species. And since we are hunters, have always been hunters, and we're always going to be hunters, I know what our ecosystems can afford to give us right now. And those are introduced species. So that's how I choose to look at that.
I've never heard that perspective before. I really like it. It's such a good way of thinking about it. And especially the population dynamics, like take a few and you just increase the carrying capacity.
The other thing I quite want to shine a light on is that at the moment in a lot of areas, hunters are becoming our spies in a way for our native species that we still do have. I've heard of so many like tales of like, actually, no, we still do have that. It's just over there off the public track. Or actually, yeah, there's fear on this river, but 10 years ago, because I'm coming back here regularly, there used to be so much more. So I feel like, in a way, you're kind of, you know, telling your own stories that we then can put into action to save species.
Yeah, hunters are one of our greatest conservation tools in Aotearoa. You know, there's not many people that, there's not many demographics of people that get further off track than hunters. When you're moving slowly, you're seeing more. It's just one of the side effects of hunting, unfortunately. The interesting thing about that, I think, is that a lot of our ecosystem literacy sits within the hunting sector. Most hunters don't realize they have it, but to be a good hunter, you have to be able to know your trees, know what's palatable, what's not, what species eat it, what species don't, when it fruits, when it doesn't. Because we know that when we find all our palatable, like when we find koawa, right? When we find kariao tips, that's where we're going to find deer. Interestingly, it's the same places that our native species hang out because it's the same food. And so, yeah, that's how hunting and conservation go together, in my opinion. You know, on the Eastern Field Link project, we treat it as a bit of a university because a lot of hunters aren't conscious of the things they know, but also a lot of young hunters don't know this stuff yet. And so we bring hunters from all over the country to the Wairarapa. Come check some traps with us, come hunt, come do some a great fishing weekend. They're always great, fun weekends, and we always walk away with a good feed. But the great thing is about it is that we're learning about piko-piko being an indicator of deer browse. Well, if there's a piko-piko bed, the deer are going to be there. Interestingly, though, if there's no piko-piko there because the deer have eaten them, we need to shoot more deer. And if there's heaps of piko-piko, well, we probably need the deer to breed up, you know? Like, so there's a few things there that we use our traditional makinga kai species as indicators and hunting tools as well. But while we're there, hunters are prepared to go sleep rough. They're prepared to go to places other people aren't prepared to go to. And there's been more cases of hunting, of hunters finding species in places they shouldn't be than you can shake a stick at, really. So yeah, hunters, they've got a good skill set, and they're pretty keen to tackle that country that everyone else thinks is, oh no, that's unworkable. It's too steep. It's too tight. It's too tough. And chances are someone's hunted it before. So I reckon hunters are a pretty good conservation tool, eh?
For sure.
Yeah. So we've mentioned the Eastern Field Link a couple of times now. So you obviously started that, you know, noticing that numbers were in decline. So where did it go from there? Because you achieved some pretty incredible outcomes. Do you want to talk a little bit more to that?
So when we started, Doc had done a survey and they told us that we had just four pairs, eight individual fuel left in our rivers. And they told us that they probably hadn't bred successfully for like 10 years. We go, oh, that's pretty bad. And so we got together with a group of our mates. We had 250 traps fall off the back of the truck. We can't talk about that, but they turned up at our project from some miraculous place. We have no idea, but you know the people we were connected to. We've talked about them prior and we won't name any names, but they turned up on our project. Great, lightweight, self-resetting traps, and we laid them out that first year. Those four pairs of field bred 20 ducklings and fledged them.
Wow.
So imagine those for your mums, I reckon, eh? Like, imagine they tried to have kids every year and those kids get eaten every year for the last 10 years. And then one year these bloody hairy bloody bushmen turn up and put some traps out and kill some stoats, and all of a sudden everyone's got kids. It was like it was awesome. And so, yeah, every year after that we fledged around 2016 something chicks, and over the last 4 years we've fledged over 100 chicks. So now when we're fishing and hunting, you know, like, we see fjord everywhere on the project. So they're spilling out from the Waiweka catchment into the Motu and back into Te Uruwera and a whole bunch of other places too. So we reckon it's pretty successful, and we're kind of humbled by, you know, we've got over 100 active volunteers now, and we've managed to employ three of our mates as trappers on the project, and it's 30,000 hectares large, you know, and
good, I don't know. Area.
It's a solid size, you know. It's still smaller than what we want to do, but yeah, 30,000 hectares is all right. And I think the thing is, you know, at the start, we didn't think a group of seven mates could kick a project like that off and actually reverse local extinction for a population of fjord. And we didn't think that we had this knowledge or skill set or can do or financial backing to be able to do any of that. But as a group of mates, you know, as long as it's fun and enjoyable and you're getting a feed of venison at the end of the day and you're catching a few trout and, oh, you kill a few stoats while you're at it, good things happen.
Effort.
And now it's not just about Fio, right? Like, you've actually got some other pretty cool critters as well that you spied out while you were there.
Yeah, so there's kiwi. So we've now evolved, like, you would think of us as maybe a hunter-led, fisherman-led conservation project, but we partner with Matawai Marae, with Mahaki there, with Tangata Whenua-led project. Our farmers have jumped on board with us, and the way that came about was we were looking for kiwi and we couldn't find any really, and then we looked on the farms and all the kiwi were hanging out on the farms. And so the farmers were like, oh yeah, we kind of knew they were there. Okay, cool. So yeah, we've trapped all our farms, and our farmers are like some of the greatest conservationists in the project now. So we're a farmer-led conservation project, and we've actually turned into a catchment group as well. And through becoming a catchment group, we found the long tail bats, the short tail bats, we've got Hochstetter's frogs, we've got Drocomata tust wetter. A lot of people don't care about these guys because they're small, but we've got the whole works. Pawpaw Kōtea, the whiteheads are flying around, we've got Kaka, Kareerea, we've got a couple of creatures hanging around, so it's pretty nice, eh?
Far out. And you received some Jobs for Nature funding, right? What impact did that make? I mean, what doors did that open?
Yeah, so that Jobs, I really think, like, I mean, lots of people got their own political opinions and all that, and there's good things and bad things about every government, but got to thank those fellas for giving us Jobs for Nature, really. You know, they allowed us to employ one of our own as a project manager, which is brilliant, and two trappers as well. So we've got two trappers out there and a project manager as well, and it really allowed us to upscale in a big way what we do, and it really allowed some of our crew to be out there having those relationships with the ducks and with the whenua and seeing what they go through day to day. And that might sound a bit hippie to you guys, but there's nothing we like more than kind of watching the Shortland Street relationship dynamics of fjord unfolding when someone hooks up with someone's daughter and they get grumpy and they throw someone out, and, you know, like, that's always kind of hilarious when it comes to fear anyway, less so in human society. But yeah, so Jobs for Nature allowed us to kind of, employ some of our own and really upscale the project to be something comparable to what a large Department of Conservation project would have looked like in the past. Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Speaking, so pretty much the community stepped up where Doc couldn't. What's your wider community buy-in and what does Eastern Fiordland kind of mean for the region?
Well, we're hands down the largest fiord project in the region. But I think the biggest thing is that the biggest thing for Eastern Fiordland is that it's got social outcomes as well. Like, we have so many schools coming out. We run a pretty solid education program. They come out, they spend time in the bush, check traps, all that sort of thing. We run parenting courses in the bush, which is really great. Some of our schools, you know, we're from the East Coast, you know, it comes with a set of social situations. You know, some of our schools, 70% of the children at school are coming from a single maternal home. So that's mum or grandmother raising the family. And they typically work really hard to do that. Dad sometimes not in the picture. And so we bring those kids and run camps with them and they love it. And we've actually look after the childcare for those mothers and bring them out in the bush on wahine weekends and they have a great time. So our buy-in's pretty diverse and our buy-in is pretty solid. And it's not just locally. We get people fly their private planes up from the South Island to be part of the project. And a lot of crew come down from Auckland and Hamilton.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I don't know. We enjoy it.
Do you think that what you guys have done is uniquely East Coast? Like, do you think what you did, the way you went about it, could be done in other parts of the country? Or do you think there's certain elements of what allowed you to do this that is because of what's unique and special to the people and the nature and just everything about where you are physically?
I think people are part of their ecosystems, they're part of their landscape. So of course it's going to be unique to place, but I think that people eating from the land and practicing rongoā Māori from the land and those mahinga kai skills, those traditional foods that we pride ourselves on having that interrelationship with on Eastern Fiordland, I don't think that is unique to Eastern Fiordland. I don't think that's unique to the East Coast. I don't think that's even unique to Aotearoa. We, as people, all of us tend to eat, well, maybe we don't. I think all of us tend to eat from the bush. I don't know many people. I don't know. Do people walk along and eat berries and fruit and harvest quite along the way for the evening meal?
We do, but quite often when we take people into the bush and we're like, oh, try this, they're like hesitant. And we are very persistent these days. And they're like, oh yeah, kareo tastes like asparagus and give it back to you. And it's...
I've tried to indoctrinate my friends and I think that over the most common comment is, tastes interesting. Do you want another one? No.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the things like where I'm most proud of as a father is like, even with young kids, like we just decolonize our kids' palates because they're so used to sweet and salty and all of that and fatty, you know. But our kids that are coming through, and all the kids that come through the Eastern Fiordland project, you know, we have them like from day preschoolers out on the project day, so they're all eating bush tucker from the start, and so I think they don't even get a choice as to what flavors they like and don't like. They more come through going, oh, Haumia Tani has given us a kai. This must be full of goodness and must be delicious. And they get raised in those stories of the bush and who each plant is and the ways they are generous to us and the ways that we need to be generous to them also to help them flourish. And it kind of consolidates our role as bushmen within that ecosystem. So I don't know. Is that East Coast? I just think that's people. And I think that people around the world have relationships to their ecosystems and their ecosystems try and feed them and we, as then the people, try and look after them back, surely.
You have to be willing to stop and observe and listen.
But I think to what you said about the is it normal to have bush kai? Like, I think as a people we've lost so much connection to the land, because this would have been normal everywhere, not just Aotearoa. And I think the thing that it sounds, the fact that it sounds so novel and out there now is quite crazy, really, considering this is all of our heritage.
Yeah, I think so. Hey, and I think too, like our bush is really struggling in a lot of places. Hey, like with the deer, particularly, and goats and places and possums and etc. Like sometimes the bush can't give us as much kai as it would like to. Like we actually, our people have to come back to the bush, and our people have to be generous back to the bush for it to reciprocate now, I think. And so I think that's one of our greatest challenges in conservation in Aotearoa, is that we often historically have had that classic like hands-off approach, you know, Forest and Bird is classic for a day. Oh, humans need to be over here. No, you can't pick the natives. No, we're not going to eat them yet, you know. And I think that's a fascinating thing to me, is that actually for us to engage a lot of this generation, a lot of particularly this generation that's like wants instant gratification, we actually have to engage them with the true relationship with plants and the true relationship with their ecosystems, because that instant gratification comes in the way of kai. And if we can give them a kai out of the bush, they will go, oh, where's that kai coming from? Who is that? And they'll start to care about it. And when they care about it, they want to look after it. And I think that's one of the biggest tools for conservation in our generation, is that we need to reinstate mahinga kai so our next generation care about the bush, because they won't just care about it for intrinsic values, because they're too instant gratification for that. They need a reason to care about it, and one of those reasons is through mahinga kai. And we need a little bit of legislation change to allow them to connect with the place. And when they connect with it, they're going to want to do conservation work. And that's one of the biggest questions I've got for our generation, is do we keep locking our people out? And if we keep locking our people out, will we lose ecosystems? And if we lose ecosystems, whose fault is that? Because we lock the people out. We actually need to do work bringing our people back into those ecosystems and allowing them to interact the way we always have.
On that topic, and I'm going to be showing this for the first time, this is Sam's book, which Callum and I had the privilege of reading, and that concept of mahinga kai is something that shines through that book, and I loved exploring that topic. And later on you also then talk about raising kids, passing on those values and bush lollies. I do enjoy my own bush lolly from time to time, but I learned so much just, you know, a few new species that I've never considered before as mahinga kai, but also just that concept of weaving that into conservation. That's something very beautiful that I learned about.
Oh, thank you. It's humbling. I just apologize to my kids, really. Like those poor kids, they getting dragged around the bush and having to eat stuff out of the scrub. There's no McDonald's for those ones, so they're probably quite deprived, really. But yeah, I don't know how to parent any other way, so I apologize to my kids. But
hey, there's a quote here on page 106, because you know, in case you're wondering which page it's on. But what makes me most proud, this is about Eastern Fielding, what makes me most proud is how many people now care about the waiweka the way that Dad and Papa instilled the care in me. Now there's a whole community, generations deep, that won't let the whio or kiwi disappear anytime soon. In a few short years, we were able to bring the whio population back to a level where my kids can experience the same normal I had as a kid. I think there's something in that. It's like, you know, coming back to this whole conversation, if you have people caring about it, they're feeding from the Nahiri and they have a reason to be there, that's the only way long term for us to protect conservation. It's bottom up is the only way for it to last.
I think so, eh? I think so. And I think that we don't know, do a lot of things well on Eastern Fueling, but I think the thing that we do particularly well is we have really good trips, and we have awesome, everyone walks away from our weekends being like, wow, that was a lot of fun. And we learn a few things. And I think that's, well, I mean, that's what we do. I don't know. I don't know how to do conservation any other way. You know, those guys that raised me when I was 12 and 16 in the bush as a trapper, they made it so much fun. And, you know, my dad, my mum, they made going bush with them so much fun. And my grandparents, you know, we always just enjoyed our time. So I don't know. That's just what we're trying to do on Eastern Fielding. And yeah, you're right. I guess it, well, I guess I wrote it too. Maybe I'm. But, you know, it is nice to see the next generation coming through and really being in love with the bush and in love with the wild weka and reciprocating that generosity that the wild weka gives us. Yeah.
I think it's all about the power of sharing your knowledge and passing that on as well. And I feel like you guys are doing that in so many ways, both hunting, conservation, and Mahinga Kai.
Yeah, I'm sure we're handing on our terrible sides of us as well. So I'm sure there's a balance in there somewhere, eh?
I just want to make a note about your brutal honesty in the book around mental health challenges. Mm. Like, it's such a hard thing to talk about, especially as guys. Like, it's not really seen as that staunch to talk about it. You know, you've got to be the tough man. Yeah, and I just... It was really cool just to see not just the good stuff, but also the bad stuff just like transparently talked about. Yeah, definitely meant something to see that.
Thanks, bro. Like I ummed and ahed about putting that chapter in. And actually that's half, you know, the version that's in the book is a trimmed down version of that chapter. It's definitely hard to write about mental health.
Yeah.
And it's definitely difficult to open yourself up to, like I think a couple of people are going to read the book hopefully, and so like it's definitely a little bit scary putting it out there, but I thought no, it's real for me. And actually it's real. I know a lot of fellas that suffer from mental health, and I know a lot of bushmen that suffer from mental health particularly, and so I thought no, it's going in the book, you know. And I'm kind of going, you know, I'm making it through life. And you know, I suffer from mental health. I suffer from depression from time to time. And that's real, and that's part of who I am. So one of the biggest issues with depression is we try and hide it.
Mm.
And I thought, hang on, if I'm going to try and hide it when I'm putting out a book, well, that's just not authentic and it's not real. And so I thought we'd include it in the book. We touch on it. It's a chapter. And I'm really lucky to be navigating life in a positive way. That's for sure. So, yeah.
No, honestly, Sam, good on you. I've been there too, and it was really heartwarming to read and for someone to be brave enough to share their entire story, rather than just, you know, bouncing on their high notes. Because we all have them, but it takes some strength to admit that that's not life at all times. Yeah, thank you and good on you for being strong and doing it.
Yeah, ta. I mean, if it helps someone, if it helps a young fella know that there's a light at the end of the tunnel, then that's a good thing. And particularly on the East Coast here, you know, we've had a pretty tough time with the cyclones. We've had a pretty tough time post-COVID. Now this year with the land prices too, like a lot of our farmers, a lot of our bushmen, a lot of our backcountry guys are hurting pretty bad. So I figured, mental health needs to be talked about, and we need to talk about strategies around how we wrap support around people. And if my little perspective helps in that chapter, then so be it.
Yeah, for sure.
Definitely. And to me, there is another totally different topic, but also how you're helping, which is by being Sam the Trap Man and showcasing your way of the walk, which is something that also resonated with me in the book. The way of the walk, and your son always being astonished when people that are otherwisely orientated don't know that you can eat totsura berries, for example. And that made me chuckle because it is very much true, and it's seeing the world of the innocence of a small child. But, you know, becoming Sam the Trap Man, sharing all of that information, like shout out to you. Thank you for also doing that, because it's hard for urbanized oriented people to, you know, to get more in tune with nature. And I think you're doing some great mahi there to connect them.
I'm just real grateful to my wife. You know, she started telling me that my work stories were getting a little bit repetitive and that I needed to find a new audience to put those out in front of. But she said, no, you've got all these like little ecosystem niches and you're so passionate about what you do. She's like, why don't you start an Instagram? And so we started, you know, I was still rolling a Nokia 2280, you know what I mean? Like it's, and so, started an Instagram and I'm just real grateful to be able to do what I do and real grateful to be able to get paid to run around the bush every day. Like, who would have thought as a cheeky, mischievous 12-year-old that I would make it to a point where I just get paid to run around the bush as a job? Like, that's just ridiculous, you know? Like, I get paid to, like, people fly me around the country to, like, take them for a walk in the bush and, like, learn about, like, trees and plants and conservation.
We're coming on to the famous three questions. Firstly, do you have any tips or advice, practical actions people can take to help nature in their backyard?
I think the biggest thing for me is plant things to eat. There's so many trees we can plant that give us food in their backyard. You know, that's just so key. And those same species bring in the birds, which we love to see too. So I think we're in a situation where, like, domestically, urbanly, that's not even a word. But, you know, in our kind of like city situations, there's typically less possums and less rats. So there can be so much abundance of food and so much abundance of bird life living off that food. I reckon plant things, yeah.
What does conservation mean to you?
Living with our ecosystems and living in our ecosystems. Being people that notice things. Being people that... are happy being, receive gratefully and give generously to our ecosystems. That's what conservation means to me.
That's awesome. And finally, how can people find out more and get in touch, get involved in your awesome mahi?
Just at Sam the Trap Man. Sam the Trap Man on all of the social channels. We got a little website, samthetrapman.nz. But more importantly than that, if you felt like following Eastern Field Link on our social media channels, if you felt like jumping on the website and having nosy, that'd be great. But more importantly than that, even it would be just great to see you in the scrub. So come along to a Eastern Field Link volunteer weekend. We'd love to see you. And if you did feel, hey, if you own a business or you have some available funding right now, it's a really hard time in conservation. And Eastern Field Link's going through a little bit of a flux about how we move away from jobs for nature into sustainability for the long term. So if you were a funder and you had a business, any little bit helps. $500, $1,000, anything like that is just... keeps the traps ticking over, keeps those feel very happy. So that's what we're doing. That's how you can get involved. Hope we can run around the scrub together.
I've got to say, on the funding note, I reckon giving money to a community environmental group has to be one of the highest returning ways to help. Like, there's no waste. Every last penny gets used like 10 times over. And every single community group I've been involved with, at least the smaller ones, that's for sure. I'd love to pop along and volunteer one day if you've got a spare space going.
Come through Cozy Team. It'd be lovely to go scrub with you guys. And it's not too far. It's a hop, skip and a jump from where you guys are. So
I used to be privileged enough to work with Fio as a volunteer placement, and they must be one of the most feisty. Amazing. Yes, also grumpy and feisty, but just the charisma of that species. I'd love to see the work that you're doing for them, because they're if they're not your favorite, then there's something wrong with you.
They're super comical, team. We really enjoy hanging out with them. And they're so like, they know people on our project now. And it would have been the same with you, Anna. It's like one of those things where, like, when they're used to people, they'll just like hang out within a meter of you. We're often swimming with them in our rivers over home now. So it's cool.
Yeah. For me, it was a breed for release. So they actually, some of them were too friendly. And you're like, no. You're going out into the wild. You need to go away from me. Like, you're not welcome that close. You're a wild bird. And others were just like, I don't want to associate with you anyway. I'm just going to observe you, but not get close.
They're such cool birds, aren't they? Yeah. We're so lucky to be able to do this work that we do. With these incredible species. And I'm just real grateful for the work you guys are doing, really. It's like communications in the conservation sector is we don't have enough of it. And you guys do such a great job of hosting things like this podcast.
Thank you.
Very inspiring, Tim.
Thank you. It's nice to hear, because I'm usually the one who hides in the bush and doing species work, and but it's like you say, it's needed, and stepping up and doing something else is sometimes what's needed.
My philosophy is, like, the people that give their time to help nature are the heroes of our generation. I'm just some sleazy marketer at a desk that sits in an office and hoping to help, but the people that put their time in and stay in the Nahiri or in the ocean or wherever they're doing conservation are not the type of people typically that say, hey, look at me, give me some attention. And I think that the space needs more attention, because if more people learn about and get involved in conservation, anything's possible. But that's the foundation we need. Like, without that foundation, I don't see much hope for the long term of our nature.
Absolutely. And I think it does take, to run conservation projects, what we found out from being a rebel of hunters that don't know what we're doing and running organizations, like, what conservation needs is not just trappers on the ground, though, hey? It's marketers, it's lawyers, it's those bankers that can run the books, you know? Like, it's there are many different skill sets within conservation. And I think a lot of those times, the administrative roles are the roles that are lacking. So I don't think you can underplay the value of communicators, of accountants, of lawyers in keeping our birds safe. I think a lot of our community conservation groups desperately need those skill sets.
For sure. And I think for anyone who's listening and you're thinking, I find stoats sticky, I don't want to touch them, or I don't know where I fit into this, but I have a skill, chat with your local group. It's not always about giving back and helping the environment. I mean, that's great. But to me, I came for the environment. I left with a community, and I've stayed involved in conservation ever since, largely because of the people that and the connection it brings me. We were on Tiritiri Matangi Island a little while back, and we bought these really cool hand-knitted beanies. I had one with a kokako, and I think you had a couple. And there was a bunch of elderly ladies who couldn't physically do the traps, but they could knit. And that raised so much money for Tiri. So, you know, it's together, but diversity makes us stronger. And, I've always found that I've been welcomed with open arms, and it's just such a wholesome way to spend your time.
Everyone's got a role to play in their ecosystem.
For sure. And just one last note. This book, if you're watching it on video, Sam the Trap Man, has just been released. If you're not watching it on video, then you can't see the book, but that's okay. It's a really good book. We've been reading it frantically the last few days. Where can people find it?
You can find that in all your local booksellers. So the likes of Paper Plus, Whitcools, any of the independent bookstores, they should all stock it, or at least I hope they're stocking it. Failing that, you're more than welcome to come on to my website and grab yourself a copy as well. But good thing is it's really important, I reckon, to support your local bookseller, because books are great things. Mine might not be, but the rest of the books are probably great things.
No, yours totally is. And now we're back at New Zealanders being too humble.
There's some good yarns in there anyway. Eh? I think there's a whole chapter on like how to dig a decent long drop. So there you go.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks so much, Sam.
Yeah, and thank you for your time. It was,
keep a up great the epic yarn. Mahi. Awesome work.
Appreciate you guys. Eh? We'll look forward to seeing you over on Eastern Fueling.